Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. Happy Earth Day. On this day, back in 1970, 20 million people in the United States took to the streets to demand politicians take bold steps to protect the planet. The first Earth Day led to the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency and the passage of the Clean Air, Clean Water, and Endangered Species Acts. Well, today, 49 years later, nearly 1 billion people in 192 countries around the globe are expected to take to the streets, join various activities, and demand, once again, bold action to protect the climate. This year's theme is Save Our Species, and it's meant to bring attention to the rapid extinction of species around the globe, which is directly linked to human activity, which causes climate change, deforestation, and pollution. On today's One Planet series, we are marking Earth Day by talking about penguin species. While penguins are not on the official endangered species list, their populations have rapidly declined over the last few decades. It is estimated that there are around 20 million breeding pairs of penguins living in the Antarctic. Scientists who study them say that climate change is an imminent threat. Penguins depend on sea ice for their food and breeding grounds, but with melting sea ice and shrinking glaciers due to warming temperatures, penguins are struggling to adapt. According to a 2018 study in Nature Climate Change, 70% of king penguins would be forced to leave their breeding grounds or face extinction. Joining us to talk about what it will take to save penguins are two guests. For more than 35 years, Ron Naveen has been manually counting penguins and charting their population decline in Antarctica. Ron founded Oceanides, the world's only nonprofit Antarctic research program that tracks penguin population data. Ron is featured in the award-winning documentary film, The Penguin Counters, and this month he stars in the new PBS NewsHour series, Warnings from Antarctica. It's about climate change's impact on Antarctica, and we have links to that. I hope you can watch it at yourcallradio.org. Ron is also a former lawyer for the EPA, and he joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Ron. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here on Earth Day and hoping we can enthuse more and more people to think about the planet and using penguins as a vehicle to get our heads on straight and all work together to deal with climate change and adapt to a warming future.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, let's definitely hope we get our heads on straight. And Ron, I loved watching you in the NewsHour segment, and we'll talk about that later. But thank you so much for all the work that you do. We're also joined today by Dr. Bill Fraser. Bill is a polar ecologist who specializes in the ecology of Southern Ocean seabirds and penguins. In the late 80s, Bill's research provided the first evidence of observable ecological changes linked to climate change. Bill is president of the Polar Oceans Research Group. His research was the subject of the book Fraser's Penguins, A Journey to the Future of Antarctica. Bill has researched the Western Antarctic Peninsula since 1974, and Dr. Bill Fraser joins us from Sheridan, Montana. Hi, Bill. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your program. I have caught your program on and off here in remote Montana. I love it.
Oh, wow.
It's a real pleasure to join you.
Wow. Well, thank you. And I love both of you dedicating your lives to penguins and saving the planet. So just huge respect to both of you. And thank you for joining us. I just want to ask you both how you're reflecting on this Earth Day. When you think about the millions of people that took to the streets back in 1970, and then we had the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, there was so much awareness raising. Here we are with people getting arrested. The Extinction Rebellion last week in London resulted in arrests around the globe. We've got kids who are striking on Fridays to demand politicians take action on climate change. Ron, let's start off with you. How are you reflecting today? What are your thoughts around the significance of this Earth Day?
My reflection is clearly that we can't give up. There's certainty that the planet is warming. The penguins that Bill and I have been working on forever are certainly indicators of change. And Bill and I have both been around long enough that we can tell you that there are places we can go now in the Antarctic that we couldn't go 20, 30 years ago. The glaciers have receded, for example. There are beaches we can walk that we couldn't walk when we first started going to the Antarctic. Both Bill and I have experienced and seen right in front of our eyes penguin colonies that have shrunk. The other part of this is clearly that the work that I do, that Bill and his colleagues do, we have to keep this going. We have long-term data sets that are showing the fluctuations and trends, rises and falls of these penguin species numbers. And once we detect a change, we have to keep understanding or try to understand better why those changes are happening. So my reflection on Earth Day is, as I mentioned earlier, penguins are us. They need food to eat, have to have a good home and a healthy environment, have to keep producing offspring to keep the species going. I worry about the future and whether it's going to continue to be the case for the penguins and even for us humans, whether we're going to adapt or not. So my reflection is just that this takes time. There are a lot of people that haven't gotten the message yet about climate change. I'm very, very happy at this moment in time that climate seems to be more on the lips of people, at least in our country and in Europe, than ever before, and that's great. I'm hoping that the coming political debate, certainly with our presidential election coming in another year and a half, that climate change will be more of a factor. But we can't give up. We have to keep marching forward. We have to keep collecting the data, publishing papers, and forcing, with those papers and documents, forcing the politicians to do a better job.
Bill, what would you add?
I would echo what Ron so elegantly articulated, in the sense that, we have seen in our lifetimes, say the last four decades, we have seen climate change in action. And, you know, I recall in graduate school talking to my major professors. They agreed that climate change, you know, is sort of a pattern that you see over long-term timescales, historically. And so I remember my major professors saying something like, well, yeah, there is climate change, but you're never going to see it in your lifetime. And so, you know, fast forward four decades, and here we are. The area where Ron and I have spent much of our lives, the Western Antarctic Peninsula, the midwinter temperatures there have increased by 7 degrees centigrade in the last roughly 50 years. So we've seen it. I mean, we literally have lived through it. And my sense right now is I agree we need to keep putting the information forward. I am extremely frustrated with sort of the how things have stalled out here in the United States. We've gone from being leaders, environmental leaders, global environmental leaders, to, you know, we've got countries that are sort of laughing at some of our policies now. So I have a deep sense of frustration about how this is playing out. Although I'm optimistic, and I'm optimistic primarily because of especially the youth movements that are occurring globally that are demanding change. I think they're the ticket to begin changing things around.
The Antarctic Peninsula is an 800-mile stretch of land that is warming faster than almost anywhere else in the world. Bill, I was struck by what Ron said about how you now can go to places today that you could not get to 30 years ago. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I mean, Ron is correct. And actually, just because of the nature of Ron's work, he has seen a lot more of the peninsula than I have. You know, I actually just came back from our study site a couple months ago, and just in the year that I was gone, our study area, which covers about 250 square kilometers, we have seven new islands that have emerged from the glacier that was covering them just a year ago. There's beaches that are new beaches that are exposed. Some very, very scary things is that we actually are now seeing some beachheads that are roughly 50 feet above current sea level. And so these are beaches that at one time were covered by the ocean. And so it's a real vivid, it's a vivid experience. I mean, if you're paying attention, it's remarkable what's happening in Antarctica.
Ron, what else can you tell us about the ecosystem there? Besides penguins, what other species live in the Antarctic Peninsula?
Well, there's quite a few seabirds and a lot of seals also. Cormorants called blue-eyed shags, predatory gull-like birds called skuas. There's Weddell seals and crab-eater seals, lots of whales. The more we look at this, it gets very, very complicated, and I'm sure Bill will agree, the more and more we do this, the more and more questions arise as to why the ecosystem is changing. In the peninsula where we both work and have worked, Gentoo penguins seem to be faring quite well. Their numbers are increasing. But then again, this year in an area, part of the peninsula called the Gerlache Strait, we actually saw a lot of breeding failures amongst the gentoos, which recently have actually been successful. It's getting warmer. There's more moisture in the air. I mean, let's not forget Antarctica is truly a desert. It's not supposed to get too much precipitation. But in recent years, like this last one, I mean, we had excessive amounts of snowfall in Gentoo penguin breeding areas, and they just failed. There's one nest site where we typically have more than 1,000 chicks to count in January and February. Our official nest count this year was one. Shocking. There's another site that we go to where there are Adelie penguins and Gentoo penguins a couple of years ago. It was all rain and muddy and mucky, and that's something we're seeing more and more in the peninsula. Breeding conditions are not what these penguins are used to seeing in the past, having to cope with a lot of precipitation, making their nesting stones wet or difficult for them to reproduce. I've had blue-eyed shag colonies that have totally disappeared from a couple of locations. And then we have the interesting phenomenon of all the humpback whales coming back in numbers. And there's a big issue and concern about how much krill there is, the little shrimp-like crustacean that is literally the power lunch of the Antarctic. Everybody eats it, from the crab-eater seals to the humpback whales to the penguins. And krill numbers have seemingly declined. Either the krill stock has shrunk or it's moved the fishing out there, but I'm of the view, and I think Bill is too, that it's unproven exactly whether fishing is having an impact. What's probably going on is this is climate change. Climate changes in the Antarctic Peninsula driven by climate change to the north of the Antarctic that's making its way south. So we've got lots of questions to explore. It's affecting every bit of life in the Antarctic.
Bill, what are your thoughts about krill and how it's being affected by warming waters?
Yeah, it's, I think as Ron intimated, it's kind of controversial. There are, I'd say over the last 5 years, there's been a few papers that, you know, one paper that suggests that the krill are in fact decreasing, other papers suggesting that they're not decreasing. There's a recent paper that suggests that the range of krill is contracting to the south. I can tell you within the context of our study site, And this is the larger grid over which we work, which is roughly 200,000 square kilometers. We have seen absolutely no changes in krill populations since we began obtaining data over that spatial domain. We see a lot of variability year to year in terms of total biomass, but we haven't seen a trend yet. One thing I should qualify is that we work in the sort of the southern half of the Western Antarctic Peninsula. What's going on to the north is where things get a little bit confusing, in terms of whether things are whether krill are increasing or not. So it's kind of a mixed bag. I think there's stability in krill populations where we work. I'm not so sure that's the case further north.
Dr. Bill Fraser is a polar ecologist who specializes in the ecology of Southern Ocean seabirds and penguins. He has researched the Western Antarctic Peninsula since 1974. We're also joined by Ron Naveen, who has been manually counting penguins and charting the population decline in Antarctica. Ron founded Oceanides, the world's only nonprofit Antarctic research program that tracks penguin population data. And today we are marking Earth Day by talking about what is happening with penguins in the Antarctic, what is being done to save them. If you have any questions or comments for our guests, you can give us a call, 866-798-8255. How are you reflecting on this Earth Day? You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's take a step back. Since you both have dedicated your lives to raising awareness about what's happening to penguins and to really saving them, when did you first learn about penguins, and why did you decide to get so involved? Bill, let's start with you.
I was born in Argentina, and I recall when I was a child just simply seeing Magellanic penguins come to the beaches where we used to go to as kids. After that, penguins kind of dropped out of sight, and at least in my mind. And I was reintroduced to them in the mid 1970s, 1974, when the individual that turned out to be my major professor at the University of Minnesota asked me to do a film for him on the Antarctic Peninsula. Related to kelp gulls, which is it's a black-backed gull, not atypical to what you may have in California. But I realized when I was making this film that penguins really caught my attention, and they, very slowly became the focus of my interests, and I've just pursued that ever since. And I just find them fascinating. Once you understand their life histories, they offer a tremendous window into how ecosystems operate. And so, I sort of essentially devoted my life to really understanding these species in depth, and as a result, being able to kind of use them to monitor environmental changes.
And Ron, you used to be a lawyer for the EPA, but you left government back in the 1980s to start Oceanides. This is a nonprofit that tracks the health of penguins. Why did you decide to leave the EPA and start an organization to focus on penguins?
The longer-term story, actually, is I have to go back to when I was maybe around 13 or 14 years old, growing up in northeastern Pennsylvania. I think the true gist of why I'm doing what I'm doing now starts way back then. I'm a bird watcher at heart, always have been and always will be. Despite going here and going there and trying this and trying that, I keep coming back to birds. I did have legal training. I only went to law school to stay out of the Vietnam War. There was a year deferment, and I could keep away from holding a rifle, which I didn't want to do. And wound up becoming a lawyer, practiced privately, and didn't like it. So I wound up going to government, working at EPA, doing air pollution law and noise pollution law. But the real excitement for me occurred a few years into that when a job opened up at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and I switched to NOAA, and actually for 4.5 years was the U.S. government's marine mammal attorney. And it was at that time that I got to really marry my love of natural history with science, getting to understand biology and statistics and population dynamics, because I had to go to court and be conversant about all these things. It really made me a much more effective, I think, proponent of environmental causes, because I could talk not only about the law that was involved, but I could identify the species that I was talking about and talk articulately about what I wanted to do. The penguins come about because when I left government, I just really wanted to get back to the natural world. Oceanides came a few years after I was leading natural history trips, and there's a really good friend of mine on those trips named Tom McIntyre, who's now retired from NOAA. Tom had been to the Antarctic as an observer on Japanese whaling ships, got me thinking about going south, and I just really wanted to see penguins, and eventually got hired to work in the Antarctic. Burned out after about 3 years of being an expedition leader, started Oceanides with the sole purpose of realizing that nobody had ever started marking down and toting up who's living, which animals are living at each of the different landing sites. And that was the time when the treaty system adopted a new rule requiring all human activities to be by environmental impact statements. And so this project of mine, the Antarctic Site Inventory, was born to try to assist the ability of, say, tour operators in describing their activities to the various governments that sanction their going south. So it's just gotten to be a bigger and bigger thing. I mean, penguins, I have been captivated from the first day in January of 1983, standing on a beach at Deception Island, when a chinstrap penguin ran up to me and basically squawked its head off as if it wanted to check my passport. Who are you? This cute little animal, they don't have knees like we do. They're more fused and they're short legs and they wallow around like cute little humans. My heart was captured, and it got to the point that I did not want to do expedition leading anymore, but wanted to make sure that we started collecting data regularly. And we actually just finished our 25th season of the Antarctic Site Inventory, and I'm very, very proud of that. If for no other reason now, because of all the data that Bill referred to earlier, it's really getting warm down there. We can track over many, many years now the changes and the trends, and it's really important that for all of us who are collecting these kinds of data, they continue to come in. The planet is going to keep changing, and I'd like to be providing data and information that helps myself and my team and others try to figure out what's going on as the planet warms.
That is Ron Naveen. He has been manually counting penguins and charting the population decline in Antarctica for more than 35 years. He is the founder of Oceanides, the world's only nonprofit Antarctic research program that tracks penguin population data. We're also joined by Dr. Bill Fraser, a polar ecologist who specializes in the ecology of Southern Ocean seabirds and penguins. Bill has researched the Western Antarctic Peninsula since 1974. And on today's One Planet series, we are marking Earth Day by talking about what it will take to save penguins. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question or idea or an experience you wish to contribute to today's conversation, call us at 866-472-5792. 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment at the show's website, set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org, and you can also tweet us at yourcallradio. The Mueller Report, your thoughts unredacted at 11 o'clock, 1/2 hour from now, right after your call, here on 91.7 KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with Susan Devon Harness about her new book, Bitter Root, a Salish memoir of transracial adoption. She explores her search for answers to questions about race, identity, and family as an American Indian woman adopted by a white couple. That is tomorrow. And then Wednesday, we will air one of our special shows about Japanese internment. And on that show, we were joined by Chizu Omori, a writer and activist who at age 12 was forced from her home to a Japanese internment camp in Arizona. That was in 1942. We'll also hear from Gilda Temamarokin, who is from Guatemala. She left by herself at 16 to come to the United States. She is now studying at UC Berkeley. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can send us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. You can also find our show there and listen to the podcast or sign up for the podcast. If you'd like to join today's show, we are marking Earth Day by talking about penguins, how climate change is affecting them in the Antarctic, and what we can do to save them. And if you'd like to talk about how you're reflecting on Earth Day, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We're joined today by Dr. Bill Fraser. He has researched the Western Antarctic Peninsula since 1974, and Bill is president of the Polar Oceans Research Group. Ron Naveen founded Oceanides, the world's only nonprofit Antarctic research program that tracks penguin population data. They just finished their 25th season. Ron, you are featured in the incredible PBS NewsHour series, Warnings from Antarctica, and I hope our listeners can take time to watch it, because it's one thing to hear about penguins, but it's obviously a very different thing to actually see just how silly they are and sweet they are and how they take care of their babies. And when you were interviewed by William Brangham, you said, "I have the best job on the planet. Penguins can teach us something about life on the planet." Can you talk more about that? Elaborate on that.
For sure. It was an incredible experience being with the PBS team. They were pretty enthusiastic, to say the least. I love what they've put together. Part four of the four-part series airs this Wednesday, and they're also dropping that day the four-part podcast that they put together. Penguins are us. They do teach us something about life on the planet. We humans tend to ignore the fact, I think, and I'm trying to say this gently and nicely, that we simply are biological creatures just like every other biological creature on the planet. So to get to know penguins and how they live and how they die and how they reproduce gives us a window into the fragility of life that we as humans face. I alluded earlier today to the idea of having food to eat and a good home and a good environment. These few vital factors, and I'm speaking very generally now, of course, are truly important vital factors for all biological creatures. We and the penguins need to have a food supply that's regular. We need to have a good environment and a good home, and we have to keep reproducing kids. I mean, the big worry, obviously, about Antarctica and the polar ice cap and the north going away and melting is global sea level rise, which will undoubtedly threaten the homes of millions of people, cause disruption to the food supply chain. What's going on with the gentoos, the adelies, and the chinstraps in the warming, or the warmed Antarctic Peninsula, gives us a bit of an insight about what we're going to have to face in the future. And, you know, I'm hoping that we humans in the future will be like the Gentoo penguins are now in the peninsula, that we will somehow figure out how to adapt, get food we need if, say, the krill we want to eat is not available. So I find penguins to be a wonderful mirror of our own lives, and by getting to know them, it's an interesting way to get folks to think about climate change. I can, as the best of them, can point fingers and say this should be done and that might be recommended, but I'd much rather have people think that they're penguins and figure out what it means to live like a penguin and then think, oh my God, that applies to me too as a human. And eventually, we'll all start thinking and working together. It's a slow, long, uphill slog, but about penguins or thinking about birds in your own backyard, whether it's where I grew up in northeastern Pennsylvania or where Bill grew up in Argentina and now living in Montana, just getting out into the wilderness and getting to understand how other animals live gives us a window into our own lives. Again, it's a bit of a stretch and a bit of a process, but it's really important, I think, for all of us to connect with the planet in a visceral way and not just think if you see something on our computer screen, it's okay. You got to go out and smell the roses, so to speak.
Hmm. Bill, what would you add?
I would, if I'm reading between the lines in terms of what Ron is saying, one of the things that both of us have observed on the peninsula is that, yeah, climate change comes with very clear winners and very clear losers. On the peninsula right now, emperor penguins and adelie penguins are the losers. Gentoos are the winners. Chinstraps, to some extent, also. But really, the thing here is that for the reasons Ron was mentioning, humans tend to divorce themselves from the idea that they would ever be losers, and we know for a fact, even over millennial timescales or evolutionary timescales, that humans are just as vulnerable as anyone else. Any other species on the planet. And so penguins, you know, penguins are kind of showing us what sort of changes in the environment could potentially lead to have serious consequences to us, with sea level rise, of course, being probably at the top of that list.
Can you both talk more about the declines and what you have seen in terms of how climate change actually affects the penguins? So, for example, temperatures have risen 9 degrees, more than any other place on Earth. This past year, the sea ice cover in Antarctica was down by over 66,000 square miles. And I guess for those of us who aren't there and can never probably will ever visit Antarctica, you can watch movies and watch how the ice is melting. And these glaciers, when they drop, I mean, the ice is so, so loud. I mean, that's pretty much what most people will see. And then, so we learn that the chinstrap penguins have declined by 50%. The adelie penguins, is it between 70 and 85%? And Bill, can you talk more about, like, why this is happening? How does climate change directly affect these penguins?
I was afraid you were going to ask me that. It's actually a pretty complicated picture. We have sort of some long-standing hypotheses that much of what we're seeing reflected in changing populations of penguins is ultimately linked to the presence or absence of sea ice. One of the things, there's a bit of a misconception. People tend to say, well, the sea ice is melting, and what's actually happening is that the sea ice simply isn't forming anymore. And so, to us, at least the research that we've done, sea ice is a bit like an engine that drives Antarctica. There are so many species, and so many mechanisms that depend on the presence of sea ice that much of the hypotheses we've been addressing deal with trying to identify kind of the mechanisms by which sea ice affects food webs. Sea ice might affect precipitation. And the picture that's coming around is that sea ice is, for example, sea ice affects krill recruitment, meaning it can influence the abundance of krill over very large scales. You may have a year in which krill are very abundant. You think the penguins are doing great, they're going to do great. But we now know that another thing has kicked in because of climate warming, which is increasing precipitation. And primarily in Antarctica, that precipitation in the spring when these penguins are nesting falls in the form of snow. And it's counterintuitive. I mean, you would never think that snow would affect a penguin in Antarctica. But it turns out that penguins are extremely sensitive to snowfall. They can handle a little bit of snow, but they can't handle the levels of snow that we're documenting now. Like this year, like Ron alluded to earlier, this was a record snow year in our study region. And it had devastating effects on the populations we were working with. And so I don't think we truly have captured mechanistically a full understanding of how this system is unwinding, but I think we're pretty close. Without a doubt, sea ice is a main driver of a lot of these mechanisms, whether they're food web related or precipitation, access to habitat, that sort of thing. And now we're looking at the details. You know, exactly how is it that more or less sea ice translates to more or less penguins?
And Bill, what happens to the penguin eggs when it snows and rains?
It's catastrophic. What we have seen many, many times is that, for example, Adelie penguins are especially vulnerable because they breed early. But the peak egg laying for Adelie penguins occurs around the 20th of November. And you can imagine during that spring, say beginning in September, October, you get these really incredible blizzards that come through, a lot of snow. And the snow, you know, the birds can deal with the snow as long as it's sort of dry. But what's invariably happening is you get this spike in temperature, air temperature, and the snow melts, and occasionally that spike in temperature comes with rain. The snow melts very, very quickly. And just because of the way some of the colonies are situated on the landscape, and the colonies just flood. And so you will see, you know, penguins trying to incubate their eggs in 6 inches of meltwater. And inevitably, that's just catastrophic mortality, that the eggs don't hatch. And if there are a few chicks that do hatch, they're just living in this really, really wet environment they're not used to. And so physiologically, they just can't maintain their body weight.
So because that happens, are they trying to relocate their breeding grounds?
That is a really good question. We have no evidence that Adelies are physically moving, say, to the south, where things would be more, more benign to their life history. We do see some evidence that Gentoo penguins will actually move their colonies. I mean, they'll show up on the breeding territories and kind of check things out, and they realize that the site they nested in last year is covered in snow, so the entire colony will shift a little bit to try and accommodate, say, a drier breeding environment. So it's one of these issues, you know, the losers versus the winners. And Adelie penguins are very hardwired. They, you know, it's almost like they can't make that decision to move the colony even a few feet, whereas gentoos are a little bit more adaptable, and so they will move.
Ron, whenever we do shows about what's happening in the Antarctic or just climate change in general, as Bill said, so many people say that the sea ice is melting, which is a huge factor. We don't hear as many people talk about the fact that sea ice is not forming, as Bill said. Can you talk more about that and what that means exactly?
Well, I mean, it contributes to the conundrum. The Antarctic is the size of the U.S. and Mexico combined, and more than 99% covered by ice, and that big ice dome can be up to 2.5 miles thick. It's that huge dome that's cracking, splitting, melting, and moving away. There's been some controversy in, I guess, the public literature, newspapers, for example, that, oh my God, the sea ice is up or down. The real issue is that the ice is melting from the continent. Sea ice is also changing, too. As Bill pointed out, and he's absolutely correct about this, without the winter sea ice, the krill, the baby krill coming up to the surface, don't have any algae to feed on underneath the ice, and perhaps a whole year class of krill can be lost. Then again, krill are a very long-lived crustacean, 6-7 years or more. So even if you have 1 year class that's harmed or knocked down to zero, it doesn't necessarily mean that the whole stock of krill is going to go away. I was struck in what Bill was saying by the fact that, yes, there's no question gentoos are moving to the south. We're actually tracking them moving and starting to breed much farther south than they have, say 20, 25 years ago. But this gets back to a point that both of us have talked about earlier in the show, that this is an incredibly complicated thing. We're talking about the Antarctic Peninsula and all of its penguins stretches north to south, maybe 250 miles or more. At the far southern end of the range where Bill has been working in the Arthur Harbor area all the way down to Marguerite Bay, the performance of Adelie penguins in that southern part of the peninsula is quite a bit different than up to the north. So those of us who are researching this, detecting the change, and then trying to find answers, it gets to be quite complicated because from sector to sector, region to region, sub-region to sub-area, there are differences, and that's compounded from year to year to year. So we forge on and we keep moving and trying to understand better how it all fits together, but it's a very complicated picture. Everybody thinks the Antarctic is such a simple ecosystem, and I'm sure Bill would agree with me. I think it's pretty darn complicated, and the more and more I take a look at it and try to figure it out, the more questions arise. And that's good. That's what science is all about. We want to keep marching forward and trying to figure out the changes. But the warming springtimes and summers now are devastating. And just to repeat again, yes, the idea of winners and losers, to get to one of our regular gentoo colonies this last year, devastated by heavy snow and producing a chick count of only one chick at this formerly hugely productive colony is quite staggering and quite eye-opening, and I'm obviously anxious to get back next season and see what it's like then.
And Ron, how are you seeing penguins adapting to these changes?
Well, the gentoo penguin expansion is one adaptation. They do seem to be winning and changing. We're very good at tracking what they're eating because the color of their guano suggests to us whether they're eating fish. It'll be white guano or pink or reddish pink. It'll be then sometimes they're starving and it's just green stomach bile coming up. So we're noticing more and more penguins eating more and more fish these days. That's a little bit unusual. The way it's timed with the adelies going first amongst the three, hopefully to spread out the moment when those adults are going to need krill, the most protein-rich of the fish, to feed their kids. But times during the breeding season, we're, at least I'm encountering more and more fish being fed to the kids rather than krill. It's an obvious change to me. Instead of seeing colonies of chick rearing just covered in pink guano, there's a profusion now of white in some places, meaning...
Oh, I think we're having some problems with Ron's line. Ron, are you still with us?
I am. Can you hear me okay?
Okay. Yeah, you're there.
You want me to repeat what I just said?
Yes, just the last part of that.
Sure. It's trying to keep track of the penguin's diet by watching the guano that comes out. The guano will be colored pinkish red or reddish pink if it's krill they're eating, and fish guano comes out. And we're noticing, at least I'm noticing in many places, that during the peak of chick rearing, when the chicks start creching at age four, gathering in large groups, seeing more and more fish rising. Maybe it'll change next year, but some of us are noticing.
We have just a couple minutes left. What else would you like to share with us about penguins? What stands out for you? How long do they live? Bill, what interesting things can you share with us about penguins?
I think something that this is a generalization, but the interesting thing about penguins in general, not talking specifically about Antarctic species, but is that penguins tend to occupy some of those productive areas in the southern hemisphere, in the oceans of the southern hemisphere. In other words, their populations tend to be focused on these areas of very high production, and those areas are also very, very attractive to humans because they're high production, there's huge fisheries potential. In some areas, there's the availability of hydrocarbons. And so penguins are actually a remarkable indicator of ocean health and how humans are impacting the ocean. They are, like I said earlier, they are a window into kind of the health of our planet. And that is probably the first thing I tend to think about when I'm just thinking about the future of penguins. I think what a shame it would be to have them disappear, given what we know about what we could be doing differently as a species to assist the planet.
And Ron, what would you add?
What I would add is that penguins have been around for maybe as long as 60 million years. They seem to have evolved and survived through many changes on this planet. So in addition to all we've been talking about, the winners and losers surviving, somehow adapting to they just seem to me, as Bill said, to not only be indicators of ocean health, but they do seem to suggest to me, as we've been talking about, some things that we humans need to think whether we're going to make it for a few more thousand years. I'm also one of the things that strikes all of us who work on penguins, especially in the Antarctic, is how Antarctic penguin knowledge links to this incredible Antarctic exploration history. Some of the first penguin banding took place. Great French explorer Jean-Baptiste Charcot overwintered at Petermann Island in 1909, and that's a place where my project has camped for 5 years. Used to be the southern end of the penguin range. They've now moved further south. But by working on penguins, you get to work and understand better some amazing human history. It's why all of us love going to the Antarctic, keep wanting to go back. There's an amazing combination of science and history and survival that's there right in front of our eyes. And everybody loves penguins, talks about penguins, counts penguins, wants to act like a penguin waddling around. They are little people that remind us about what's best on the planet and what hopefully you to conserve for many, many, many generations to come.
And just quickly, Ron, we're almost out of time, but what are your thoughts about the impacts of tourism on Antarctica? Because in the PBS documentary, we see people standing just a couple feet away from penguins. What are your thoughts about that for people who would love to see penguins up close? Is it a good idea to do it? Does it have an impact? What kind of impact?
Well, my project has looked at tourism impacts twice. We can't yet find any link between the levels of tourism and any penguin population changes. I actually was monitoring what was on screen during that segment pretty closely. The guidelines for all the tourists are to stay 5 meters or 15 feet away from the penguins. Although as a researcher, I'm permitted to get a little bit closer. I think everybody else does a really good job, and the companies at the moment are doing a very good job of trying to manage this. The reason that my project started was to try to get in place the data and information that would allow governments to assess in the future whether the levels of tourism are causing an impact. At the moment, I think it's being managed well, but as pointed out in the tourism segment on PBS, number of tourist ships, number of visitors is increasing. Industry is working hard to manage that, and they've done well in the past, and I'm hoping they'll continue to do so. But it's quite unlike, you know, decades ago when Bill and I first went to the Antarctic. We see many, many, many more tourist ships than we did before. It's not necessarily to mean that they're having an impact, and I can't say that they are. But we've got the data to keep analyzing it. If there is a change, we'll be able to detect it.
Ron Navin has been counting penguins and charting the population decline in Antarctica for 35 years. He is the founder of Oceanides, the world's only nonprofit Antarctic research program that tracks penguin population data. Dr. Bill Fraser is a polar ecologist, president of the Polar Oceans Research Group, and he has been researching the Western Antarctic Peninsula since 1974. Both of these men dedicate their lives to raising awareness about penguins and saving them. Bill and Ron, thank you all for your work. Thank you so much for joining us, and happy Earth Day.
Happy Earth Day. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for everything. Pleasure to be on.
Thank you. Pleasure to have you. Thank you so much. Thanks to Malihe Razazan and Leah Cesarine. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.